Welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. Now, Brendan Green has been running his company for 18 years and, along with his two directors, has built GCG into one of the leading independent health, safety and hygiene companies in Australia. And they are not done yet. This growing business is reinventing the way the industry delivers its services through tech-enabled innovation. GCG is a great example of what happens when talented people get together and play the long game. Sit back and listen to this troubleshooter talk about how he built a winning team. So, Brendan, welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
I've been wanting to get you on because I really, really admire what you've done in that business and what you and your colleagues have achieved, because it's just a great story. I mean, professional services is a hard market. It's people oriented. And, you know, you guys have grown since I met you, you've grown from 3 to 20 mil, which is outstanding. And so I thought we'd delve back a bit and I'd ask you some of the things I've perhaps not completely across myself. So you started Green Consulting Group, which is a health, safety and hygiene business in 2005.
That's right.
And so prior to that, you'd been to uni, you trained, you got your bachelor's in health, safety and hygiene, and then you went to work for BHP, which a very well-trodden path, no doubt.
Yeah, I guess getting over to WA in Port Hedland was my first sort of graduate placement with BHP, and spent a couple of years, 2.5 years there. And then I moved over to Queensland to operate in an underground lead mine with BHP as a hygienist. So I was a trainee over in WA and then ended up a hygienist with BHP Cannington.
For the uninitiated, you're going to have to define hygiene because most of us probably have a wrong definition of hygiene. So in this context, tell us what hygiene is.
Yeah, so it's basically classified as an art and a science, I guess, in interpreting and understanding exposures to things like dust and noise in the workplace.
Okay.
And working on controls to minimise exposure. So it's not cleaning toilets.
It's not cleanliness. Okay, got that. So look, it's good to get that out of the way. So you leave BHP, you're kind of done with that whole corporate. So then you start, I presume you started consulting, did you?
Yeah, I jumped straight into helping a mate as a subcontractor, actually on a BHP contract that they'd won through the Bowen Basin in Queensland where I grew up. So they were monitoring dust and noise on 8 of the BHP sites, and I went along and helped kick that off and train up some new people. So that was kind of the first run.
So I presume you're getting paid more to do that. I mean, the rate's better. I mean, what was the attraction?
Yeah, look, I think getting away from a day-to-day and trying something new with a set scope for 3 months gave me a bit of a, you know, a guaranteed income to get have a crack and see what it looked like to be out of my own. And not having kids or a house or any commitments, it made it a pretty easy decision knowing that the market, you know, there'd be a job to come back to somewhere else if I really needed it.
So we hear that a lot as well, that sometimes, you know, people, I mean, I started 22 or 23, so my responsibilities were a lot lower than they were a bit later. So what was the initial genesis of actually turning it from a sort of consulting gig to a business, and what did you see? What was the opportunity? What kind of vision did you have, if you had one at all?
Yeah, look, I went through a year, worked, you know, probably double the amount of hours that I did at BHP and earned about double. So I think I was on $50 an hour back in the day as a consultant. So it wasn't massive amounts of money probably, but it seemed like a good idea. I guess the whole process of setting up GCG came from feeling like I needed to expand the commitment from other people in the business to spread the risk and the load of the work. So being a single person, you can only do work once as a time and materials type arrangement. So it's very difficult to service more clients than what you've, you know, more than one or two. So it's kind of that getting some professionals in with great skills, you know, committing to the business and then not having to worry about them walking away. So a bit of a risk reduction and a bit of a load spread, pretty high pressure. Yeah.
You basically teamed up with some guys that you knew. That's my recollection anyway.
I went to a conference towards the end of 2005 and spread the word to all my friends and anyone that they knew that they considered to be you know, high quality people. So I basically put the word out to everyone I knew, including an old mate, Brett Jones from uni, and just started to ask the question whether anyone was interested. And I had a lot of people say they were interested. I just didn't have anyone put their hand up to actually do anything initially.
So these guys became partners. They put some money in, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, there are many entrepreneurs that struggle with that idea, but that's quite an enlightened way of thinking. So you thought, okay, I'm in the professional service game. I need to get some other people around me with some additional skills to help us expand and maybe de-risk it a little bit.
Yeah, that was it. It was a great idea. In the end, it obviously resulted in growing the business fairly rapidly from 06 through to when I met you, and bringing on additional people. So the concept had some legs. I had some queries from legal advisors and financial people saying, why would you want to do that? Like, surely you just want to run your own thing. And in the end, you know, it just worked out a lot better to do that, I think.
So your concern, I mean, about just hiring people was that, you know, there'll be a lot of responsibility, people wouldn't have skin in the game, and that you're going to be left holding the baby, whereas you got some partners who were aligned, I suppose, and we're going to share in the spoils, I guess.
Yeah, share the risk, share the hard work and the spoils. And I guess I was based in WA, within a short period of time, originally being in Queensland. So having some people involved on both sides of the country also helped with a bit of expansion planning. So, it was good.
So health, safety and hygiene, right, is a compliance-driven sector, right? And you were saying that hygiene was in the early stages of its evolvement and evolution, right? So what was the kind of idea and what was the vision? You know, where did you see the opportunity to meet the market other than just employ yourselves and perhaps get paid a bit more? You know, when did that evolve for you?
Yeah, I think at BHP, there was always programs going on for graduates and bringing people in, but every site around the country pretty much was trying to put on a hygienist and struggling. So there was always a shortage of people who had the skills. And what I saw was that meant that consultants would be, you know, called in. And we used consultants when I was with BHP over in Western Australia. And it just seemed like that was an ever-growing area. Mining, like BHP and Rio in Australia, led the way from a mining perspective anyway on the maturity of doing monitoring. They were doing it in probably the 70s, 80s and 90s. In varying degrees, and there were other big companies around the country that I'm not familiar with that were as well, but it was really the founders of the Institute of Occupational Hygiene in Australia were the chemists and the professionals. There wasn't even an occupational hygiene kind of training available. So a lot of the more senior hygienists have actually got chemistry backgrounds or chemist backgrounds and health science related things, but they kind of built the way forward and then and sold that through, I suppose, as consultants as they matured in their career. And we were lucky enough to have a couple of gurus come into BHP and teach us all about hygiene as well. And during that process, it was evident that BHP was even struggling to get people. So there was a definite shortage. There was a growing market where the regulations were requiring you to look after people with exposures, not just breaking arms and having accidents. It was actually the long-term health effects were starting to be, I guess, followed up more in the 90s and the 2000s.
So you get yourself at that point, you get yourself to 2009, you've been at it 4 years, turnover's about 3 million, I understand, at that point.
Yeah.
And that's when kind of you and I bumped into each other.
You actually reached out to ask a few questions about the industry and about what's going on in the services business. So I think we're a target industry. You must have seen something about hygiene in your time around that time. And, you know, they got to the point where I actually, you know, at the end of the conversation just said, look, I'd like you to come and have a look at my business because that's the game you're in. And from there, you came in and had a look at what we were doing and looked at, you know, the fact we didn't really have a strategy and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so I suppose, I mean, what was interesting to me, you know, there were some missing pieces really, and you were very open to getting input. Like, that's the first thing, is like you were open to getting input. And secondly, I think you were open to making some changes because you could see some of the limits with continuing to operate how you had operated. So one example, one of the first things we did is we hired the now CFO, Neville Baird, didn't we? Who's still with the business. So he's been there for over 10 years. And it looked a bit over the top at the time, maybe, to get a financial controller, but that's proved to be worth its weight in gold, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think just having a strategy and probably professionalizing our reporting and getting clear on how we actually operate with your help and with Neb's help was critical to the years that were, you know, post-GFC, pre-mining, you know, or during the mining boom, really, is when it was. So it's or the second round anyway. But, you know, those two things combined filled a lot of gaps that we had as technical people. None of us had had business training, hadn't gone to uni with any Bachelor of Business or even really seen as an adult how business operates at the, you know, at the executive level. So we had our training wheels on up until that time and still do, really, but
yeah,
got a little bit more experience now.
Well, it's interesting because 2009 was the GFC, right? It was kind of early on in the GFC. I think it was the end of 2008. We knew it was pretty bad. Yeah. And then, but mining just charged on in Australia. In fact, mining kept the country going, to be honest with you. And so you didn't see any kind of downturn in that 2009, 2010, 2011 period where the rest of the market was really running for cover. And I think that's probably one of the reasons we were interested in mining services is that we thought, okay, well, this is still going. So you started having board meetings, didn't you, every month? And you hadn't done that previously. I mean, how's that been for you?
Yeah, look, I think we used to meet monthly and look at numbers and whether we had money to pay bills, I think was the extent of our monthly meetings back in the day and what work was coming up. That was sort of the three agenda items. But I think having the board meetings, setting the strategy and actually looking forward 3 to 5 years, I think we started with a 3-year strategy with you and then built that out to more looking at 5 years ahead and over time. But just having somewhere that we thought we could go and the guidance around, well, what's important to get there and, you know, implementing better systems for better visibility, we started doing in that first 3 years as well.
Yeah.
With you know, a couple off-the-shelf products using, you know, MyOB as well as our finance software. So it was pretty basic stuff, but just putting in that formalization of looking at what we said we were going to do and how we went was a massive lift to what we were doing. And then I guess the finance structure and having access to finance was one of the early things that you said, that having the right size finance ahead of time is critical for growth.
Yeah, no, I think we got hold of a non-bank lender and we got some funding, which, we still heavily rely on that today, don't we? So, but I suppose that whole idea of getting out of the day-to-day, what's happening now and looking forward, that where to play, how to win, and looking at the market and what the market might need rather than just responding. I mean, that was a big evolution, wasn't it? And, you know, I mean, look what you've done since then, really. I mean, I think you doubled consecutively. I mean, you've been a 20% growth business now for basically a decade, 20% per annum.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of growth. I mean, that's a lot of growing pains there.
Well, I think that was probably the biggest comment that everyone feels, I think, is that change, that ongoing change is probably the hardest thing to, you know, doing poorly executed change hurt us a few times. And obviously when we did something right, it felt a lot better, but we're always doing something different and having to increase the size of our equipment, you know, the IT support, everything was changing constantly. So it was probably before cloud computing was exciting and interesting and people were confident to use it too. So old servers and all that fun stuff we had to invest in, it was a real ride over those years in the early days, that's for sure.
So look, to tell us about, I mean, I know you had some revenue concentration issues, right? So you look at Australia, you look at mining, you know, you've got BHP and Rio are the big dogs with probably, I don't know, 80% of the market between them in most sectors. So you were heavily exposed, weren't you, to BHP with a kind of probably an over-concentration at certain points. So how did you go about fixing that?
Yeah, I think we sort of learned a lesson in the GFC that concentration was a bit of a challenge in the first place, but we really didn't change our view other than chasing other work. I think it was only, you know, in that sort of 2012-13 period where we realised that we couldn't constantly rely on mining and needed to look elsewhere And we also had people on board like Brett and Dustin who'd had experience in mining and outside of mining and had contacts outside of that industry where we, you know, most of my contacts were inside the mining industry, and it allowed us to start different conversations. And then we started winning other work. I remember doing lots of tenders. We were trying to do tenders to win bigger work outside of mining. So it was, there was a lot of effort put into trying to just expand our networks and tap into some of your networks. And it was really a, you know, it took a long time to go from sort of 95% concentration to where we are at probably 55% mining now. So we still have a large proportion of mining, but
you know, in some ways you need a concentration issue to solve. I mean, it's the first thing is you need to get one, but once you have got one and now you probably, I don't know, I think nobody's bigger than 10% right now.
No, that's true. Yeah, no, we don't have anyone. In fact, yeah, the industries, when you look at them, if you split out mining, the concentration across coal, gold or metal into things like lithium and rare earth and other, that we've got a very broad spread there as well, where they'd be lucky with anything at 10%, even within the mining sector now. So, yeah, the reach is definitely helpful.
I suppose the genesis of that thinking was around that 2012-13 mining collapse, because eventually, you know, it dodged the GFC, but eventually we got a bust period, didn't we?
We sure did.
And so that was the genesis was, okay, how do we get outside of that? And you guys are now in construction, you guys are in defense. You know, you guys have done a lot in tunneling. The list goes on of the other sectors that you targeted way back then that have taken a long time, some of them to come to fruition, but they do eventually, don't they, if you keep at it and you give yourself time.
Yeah, no, we're getting into government, you know, construction, manufacturing, into those other industries. It did take a while, but with those strategies and some different, I guess, approaches to how we try and expand our services, and having health and safety there as well really helped to open some doors, I think, not just hygiene, but health and safety was more common in other industries than hygiene. So that was part of the secret. So, yeah.
One of the other drivers for that, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of people listening who've perhaps got a retail business that's exposed to Woolworths or Coles. I mean, Woolworths and Coles have probably got 80% of the grocery market between them. Most of that supply chain is overexposed to one or both of them. So what do you say to those guys that are staring at 50% revenue concentration with one customer? How do you troubleshoot that?
Oh, look, we've had some, like I said, we've got some companies we've worked for a long period of time in the mining industry as well. And it's probably only a problem if it ends. And that's the trick around client management, you know, understanding where they're going, trying to get ahead of that. Like we've just looked at a couple of clients where we've been working since 2012 with them. So it's over 10 years for three or four of our mining clients. So the concentration issue, as you've obviously alluded to, can be a problem if things go pear-shaped or stop or change, if that industry or that company has trouble. But if you can delight the clients and deliver what you say, you can extend those relationships. But
that's a good point, yeah.
Being able to raise our prices, which we don't do probably often enough, but recently we've had to review our prices post-COVID. They've stayed stagnant for 4 or 5 years. You know, some of our clients have come back and said, look, you're not for us anymore because the price was more. And we were able to just say, well, that's fine. Look, it's been wonderful, and we move on, and it hasn't affected our revenue.
Okay.
And I guess that's the beauty of spreading that exposure is, you know, one small downturn or incident won't actually cause a major disruption to your business.
So you kind of earned the right to fire your clients in a way, don't you?
I wouldn't like to use the word fire, but if we're not matched up anymore in what we want to achieve and how we want to get there, I guess that's the other way of saying it.
Yeah.
We're not afraid to lose a client if we're not aligned and we can't deliver the service for what it takes to have the people on board that we've got.
But, I mean, let's have it right. I mean, BHP and Rio are not, you know, they're out for themselves. I mean, they're not beyond applying pressure to small businesses. I mean, forget GCG. I've got hundreds of other examples of where that pressure comes to bear, and it's the same with Coles and Woolworths as well. So, you know, business owners have got to navigate that. Like you said, I really like that idea. You've either got to you know, get really tight with them and close with them. I mean, you've got to do that anyway, whilst at the same time trying to dig an escape tunnel and figure out what else that you've got to do as well. So fair play, because not many businesses can do what you've done and get to a point where you've gone from huge concentration with one giant miner down to no one's got more than 8 or 9%.
It's been a good journey, mate. And I guess the confidence over time is, you know, you're very nervous doing things like that and having that exposure, but seeing the, you know, the changes in the business and moving that risk around to other industries, it certainly gives you a lot more understanding of why the Rios and BHPs try to drive down your prices, because they want a better result for themselves. Like, I used to think they were not those two, but any of our clients who wanted us to drop our prices, you know, any other year, it's kind of like, well, we're trying to help you here. But commercially, that was just what they needed to do to maintain their business. And that's something we've done better in the last 4 or 5 years and more recently, just trying to understand the balance, reducing costs and increasing prices to sustain a good workforce. That's probably the hardest part in a services business, is that balance, I think.
And, you know, I mean, businesses, customers do whatever they need to do, and you can't take it personally. You just got to try and anticipate it, I suppose, haven't you? And make sure that you're aligned. So let's talk a little bit about, as you were growing and, you know, you're moving through, you went from 3 to 6, then 6 to 12, then 12 to 18. About 4 years ago, you tackled the whole enterprise resource planning technology change, right? So tell us about that. First of all, tell us why you determined that, you know, you needed improved technology, and then talk to us about how you went about that, and then how you had to troubleshoot it, frankly.
Yeah, I think it was probably around 2016 where we'd gone through that growth period and doubled the size of the business in 3 years to breach the 10 million revenue mark. And it became very obvious that month to month, having a non-integrated system, it was hard to match up, you know, uninvoiced revenue with the total revenue for the month and all your costs and that type of thing. And it became very clear to me that the inconsistencies in the reporting were showing that the system, you know, not being integrated were causing the problem. So we raised that at the board meeting and had a good discussion and went about a sort of a 6-month process of shortlisting some ERPs. You and I did that with the other managers, and then we found one, and we went with you know, a fairly large ERP in SAP.
So this was SAP for small business, right? So it was their small business version. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So we had an implementation process that, you know, they're hard enough generally, having a software implementation, but we had some challenges with the implementation where it didn't quite do what they said it would do out of the box, and caused some early concern and challenges, but we managed to fight through those and ended up, you know, having that system working towards, you know, into 2017.
Yeah, I'm not going to kind of let you brush over this, because I lived through this with you. And the reality was that we were oversold by a partner, weren't we, that did a very good selling job in terms of the SAP partner. And his inability to, A, understand the system that he was selling, and B, stick to any kind of timetable that you'd agreed, really caused some challenges, didn't it? I mean, I remember for a couple of months, we lost sight, you know, we basically lost sight of the numbers.
Well, we basically had to go back to using, well, we continued to use our old systems basically for 4 months until we got them to calibrate together and work properly. So yeah, I think the implementation phase was a bit of a disaster in the end, and I guess having someone who was a little less competent than what they said on and familiar resulted in that. And look, stress-wise, that was probably up there in the top five for blood pressure moments for me in a CEO role, just seeing something like that happen and the impact on people having to work very hard to do dual entry into two systems and all that other fun stuff. So cost us a fair whack of cash and a fair bit of stress, I think, in that period. But I reflected on it recently and looked at what the power of, you know, an integrated system, whether it be one like SAP or any other one on the market, having it structured right and feeding the right information to you and being clear on what that is, You know, the work we've been able to do on our performance is exceptional, having that integration. The system itself still isn't really, you know, perfect for us, and I don't think there is a perfect system for general business because you run your business the way you do. But, you know, having that power of integration, I think, is the key, whether you, whatever you use as a solution.
I mean, certainly it was a couple of years of frustration, but the other side of it, I think, you know, as you just alluded to, you couldn't run the business you're running now without it, could you?
No, couldn't have grown. The cost recovery alone, just seeing costs against projects properly, seeing time properly, you know, seeing all those things allows you to at least understand where you're making mistakes or doing very well, and where you need to focus your attention. And I think that's what we're starting to feel as a management team now, is the improvement opportunities you can determine from that are essential to that efficiency improvement, and just building a better business. So, yeah, it was the right decision. Whether it was the right program or not, it was a great decision to go integration of an ERP, that's for sure.
Look, I'll take you back to February 2020, right, when I think we just completed a five-year strategy, 2 days off-site, and we, you know, we nailed it. It was probably one of the best pieces of work we'd done, actually. And then we got hit by COVID, didn't we? Like within a few days, literally, of doing all that five-year mapping, COVID hits. So talk to us a bit about that and about how you managed a five-year strategy that effectively was somewhat worthless, at least the first year or two of it, given the fact because none of us uttered the word pandemic in February 2020, did we?
No, we did not. And, you know, it was a month later, I think, when I was at an event with a whole ton of people that everyone started to really talk about it. So I think March was when it really started to become reality in Australia and you know, more broadly. But it impacted everyone in various ways, obviously, and not in a real good way for most people. So I think the shock of actually realization for us was, you know, the first phone calls from our clients saying, "You can't come to site," was probably the, you know, the beginning of what was probably the most challenging time for us as a management team and as a board than we've ever had. And I think it showed the power of our leadership team and what we're like in a, I guess, in an emergency, and why we're probably so strong as a business, is that everyone turns to what do we need to do to help get through this. And, you know, there's no bones about what has to be done. We all chip in and make it happen. So I think we met daily for at least a month straight, and were providing updates weekly to the whole organisation through that time. And it was a bit groundhoggish. If you've ever seen Groundhog Day, if you've ever seen that movie, it was very much like that each morning, getting out of bed and heading for the computer. But it was, you know, it was some of the best work I've seen from my peers and colleagues and the whole team to basically keep the whole organisation together. We didn't let anybody go through that period. For the first month, we did, I think we got up to scenario 10, and just options and options. And then the government came through with some really great support for a company like ours with lots of people. It worked out very well for us to have that support and maintain our workforce, which is what it did. And it was a big deal.
Brendan, one of the things that you did at that strategy day was, you know, you pressed a lot of buttons around becoming more tech-enabled as a business and looking, you'd been investing in, you were continuing to say, okay, this is the future. We've got to become more tech-enabled. We've got to look at ways of delivering our services with less, you know, with more, you know, harnessing technology more. Talk to us a bit about that, because I think that's just been an outstanding initiative of which demanded you to look ahead for a few years, make the investments, appear to get nowhere, but in fact, you know, now you're starting to see some of the benefits of that. Talk to us a bit about how GCG is becoming tech-enabled and how health, safety and hygiene is going to have to become more tech-enabled.
You know, Dustin Bennett was the brainchild of our technology play from around sort of 2015-16, which was more looking forward. I mean, hygiene's always been a discipline where technology's been critical. So real-time devices like noise meters and gas meters have been around for decades. So the realization is that technology's always been part of what we do, and we've really just looked at how we can make better solutions, I guess, for our clients using new technology and modern technology, using dashboarding and software, which was not around back in the day, and just trying to give a better picture to our clients to help them make fast decisions and control exposures, I guess, has been the focus. So Dustin was like, we monitor a lot. We need to do more control. So we need to fix the issue, not just keep testing what the environment's like. And he did a mad whiteboard in 2015 that sounded interesting. And then I guess by 2018, we'd actually look to set up a group, which is our tech lab group, and get some people together within the organization to look at modern solutions and new solutions using software and hardware. And I guess the Internet of Things was sort of becoming pretty hot topic, and looking at sending data directly real time to dashboards. And, you know, we tested out some stuff, we built some applications, we built some software and tested things out, which is what we've been doing sort of 2 or 3 years now. And we're seeing a massive uptake in some of those solutions with our existing client base. So, there has always been an appetite, and GCG's built, you know, we built our first software 10 years ago for our database for efficient reporting, but we never really thought we'd get involved in anything, you know, that what we're doing now back then. So it's sort of evolved over the last 8 years, and the last 3 or 4 have been working very hard and doing a lot of research and development in that space. And Dustin, being the guru that he was back then and is now, he's you know, he's heading overseas working with some big international think tanks like NIOSH to talk about how we use real-time technology to reduce exposure and building global guidelines and just getting right into the thick of trying to improve the way occupational hygiene is delivered around the globe.
You got 100 people, you're 20 million of revenue, you got a 5-year plan. You know, what's the future look like? And you know, you've been at this 18 years now. Are you going to continue to kind of paint on this same canvas? Are you going to keep pressing forward?
Yeah, I think the excitement of, you know, what we're looking at right now, moving into away from just labor-based revenue into, you know, non-labor-based, using software and technology and doing different style of consulting and really driving down exposure, kind of enlivened a bit of a, I guess, what is a vision or a, you know, some sort of mission that was always there but not really written down or spoken. But to see that the work we're doing right now can have an impact on workers' health in a much more rapid fashion and hopefully reduce, you know, potential future illnesses for thousands of workers, I think that's what we're here for. And I think with the approach we're taking now, we've got an opportunity to lead the way in Australia and globally on that. So we're all very, very excited about the opportunity where we've got a very clear strategy over the next sort of 3 or 4 years to finish out that 5-year strategy that was built in 2020 and shelved for a couple of years. It's kind of exciting just to looking at a different way, I think, and everyone seems to be excited. So it's good.
You know, in terms of the future, then you've got a national business here, right? Do you see yourself continuing to lead the business? Do you see further potential to do things differently, to lead the way? I mean, I suppose that, you know, I'm fascinated by what gets you up in the morning.
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of options in the future for myself and other, I guess, directors of the company and the leadership team. I think the growing business that we've got, we've implemented a leadership model where there's, you know, there's more support for our for all of our different teams. It's not just relying on the senior executives to help develop careers and that sort of thing. I think I'm really keen to continue in what I do because I'm enjoying it still, and I think I've still got a bit to learn and a bit to add. But I think we've built a business that now could do without me. Whereas I think, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I felt like I was pretty important to driving it forward. And you know, the realization is we've got some amazing capability within the business. So the options are open. Like right now, I'm super keen to prove that we can hit our, you know, our targets and personally and selfishly to prove that I'm actually a pretty good CEO. Having started the business and getting that gig, you can obviously be seen as, you know, well, it's your business, you have to lead it sort of thing. But, you know, I think there's definite opportunity in the future for that to be handed to somebody else at some point. And if the business outgrows my capability, then that'll be the first thing that you and the the other advisory panel will know is that it's probably time and we can do that.
So look, if I could time travel you back to yourself at 24, what would you tell yourself at the beginning of this journey?
Get a business advisor and a coach.
So talk to me a bit about that. Yeah.
Well, I think understanding your limitation is one thing, but actually doing something about it is another. And I think fortunately for me and the rest of the team, we got some good advice at the right time. We listened. And I think it's pretty easy to imagine what we could have been like if we didn't, you know, get you on board or get a financial controller when we did. Who knows where we would have ended up? Probably working for someone else like BHP. But I think that's a reality of that journey, I suppose. And, you know, for me, when I was 34, you introduced me to someone who took me on as a coach in Phil Krenigan. You know, he asked some simple questions that I couldn't answer, and one of them was understanding my impact on other people. And that was kind of a turning point in my life from a leadership point of view. And we used Phil to sort of help us get a view forward on how we treat our clients, how we lead the business and that type of thing. So with your help on the business acumen, commercial and strategy and help on my leadership, I think those two things can't be underestimated. And I would say go and see a marketing consultant and have a look at your sales process. So they're the and find some great people. So they're probably the four or five things I would say.
Yeah, okay, nice.
It just took me a long time to do three or four of those things. I did get the right people around the table. It took a while to find you. You helped me, you know, you helped us with a lot of key things that have changed the business forever. So I think just being open to feedback and understanding where you're limited is a massive start.
I mean, it's a kind of modern thing that, but sort of shout out to Phil Krenigan, who's an executive coach, and you know he's helped a number of the people I know, and I suppose, you know, if we were sports people in a competitive, in a competitive sports environment, we'd all have a coach, right? And we'd all be getting input from that coach and help from that coach. We've seen him move into the world of work, and we kind of, and we're in a competitive world, and we're trying to compete and be world class, and yet we don't often seek out that kind of input, do we? But I think it can make a big difference, I suppose, if you, as you said, if you're open to that input and you're open to changing and having a mirror held up. Great to chat with you. Thanks for sparing the time. I know how busy you are. More power to you at GCG, and I keep powering on. You just keep, you know, turning up and painting on that canvas, and business is going from strength to strength. So good luck. And we'll get you back on again when you can tell us a bit more perhaps about the what you've done with the becoming technology enabled.
Sounds great, Mike. Thanks heaps, mate, for today and obviously for the last decade or so. Yeah.
Oh, no, well, no, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Brennan, take care.
Cheers, Mike. See you later.
So there you have it, 18 years in the trenches and still plenty of ambition to keep growing and improving. It's been such a joy for me personally to watch this company evolve and to see Brendan develop into such a well-rounded leader. Now, quick shout out to our sponsors, Oasis Partners, Corporate Advice with a Practical Bias. If you like this content, be sure to tell your friends and leave a like. Until next time, stay safe.